Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm going to read one of my essays from Better Humans, the Change Surfing columns that I publish there. The essay is on immortality, which is a topic that I was invited to write about recently and have given a lot of thought to, trying to bring together in this essay some of my reflections on the future of technology and Buddhism, which for those of you who didn't know, I'm a former Buddhist monk and have been a Buddhist since the age of 16 when I first read D.T. Suzuki and Alan Watts and Be Here Now and things like that. This essay is an attempt to pull together some of my eschatological visions of what technology may do for us in the future. So at any rate, here's the elusiveness of immortality in Better Humans this week, betterhumans.com. I was slowly giving up cigarettes in graduate school. There were many days that began with my morning self optimistically thinking about the fact that I didn't smoke much, that I would still have a low lifetime risk if I quit in my 30s, and that we were on the verge of curing cancer. So I would buy a pack and smoke one or two. Then in the late afternoon, when my blood sugar ran low, or I had been humbled in rounds of manhood measuring with other would-be intellectual giants, I would look with disgust at the pack, think about the fact that cancer was supposed to have been cured a decade earlier, that my family was riddled with cancer, and how pissed off my wife would be if my baby daughter grew up without me. I'd crumple the pack and throw it away. A day or two later, the cycle would repeat. Sometimes by 9 at night, deep into cups with my socialist comrades, I'd have another craving and look for another fix. My 9 a.m. self was a smoker, my 4 p.m. self a quitter, and my 9 p.m. self thought that the world was going to hell in a handbasket. So what difference did it make? John Elster talks about such scenarios, the peculiarity of one part of the self trying to bind the other, as the Ulysses dilemma. Some of us consider our substance dependencies a peripheral element of who we are. Some could easily lose these weaknesses, neuroses, and self-destructive behaviors and feel even more true to who we think we really are. Some people think that they aren't themselves until they take their drug of choice, whether it's a smoke, drink, Ritalin, or antipsychotic. This situation will be exponentially complicated by the radical longevity and nano-neural technologies we will soon enjoy. These technologies will force the existential question of who we think we are inescapably upon us. The waxing and waning of addictions and chemically assisted selfhood is just one sign to the attentive person that there will be a problem with the project of radical post-human life extension. Who exactly is it that will attend that cocktail party at the heat death of the universe, the smoker or the quitter? And what relationship will he have with me? I don't question the goal of immortality for any of the usual reasons. I'm quite sure that it will soon be possible and that it's completely desirable to extend lifespan indefinitely. I think that people with a radically long lifespan will enjoy life more, not less, than those with a shorter lifespan. I'm not worried about ennui or decrepitude or dependence on machines. I don't think it's any more neurotic or selfish to want to live 100,000 years than 70. I think that most people in the world will demand radical life extension, and that it will eventually be accessible to all. We may have to make some serious alterations in capitalism along the way, but that's another essay. I'm not worried, as Francis Fukuyama is in Our Post-Human Future, that radical life extension will create static, fearful gerontocracies, where legions of seniors leer at the shrinking pool of sexy young. The old will be sexy, and our brains will be as young as we want them to be. As for overpopulation, we will either make more stuff or limit our fertility, and we are already doing both. Forcing untimely deaths on our grandparents will not be one of the options we turn to. Nor do I believe most of those who say that they aren't afraid of death. If self-proclaimed death embracers don't get the same heart palpitations from close calls on the highway that I get, then they need a prescription for Prozac. We're all afraid of death, but some of us are just too afraid to admit it. No, my problem with immortality is simply that I don't exist, and you don't either. Our so-called personalities are just roiling masses of evolving impulses, memories, thoughts, and sensations. There is no central chip, no core thought, no essential memory that makes you, you. The self is a constantly changing probabilistic wave function, pretending to be a particle. At best, we need to pretend that there is a continuous discrete self, so that we can have an orderly society and an orderly life. At worst, this perceptual illusion dominates our lives and makes us miserable by constantly sucking up new needs, fears, and neurotic attachments. Until now, only a very few people have had the leisure or motivation to contemplate the illusory nature of the self, and to try to figure out a way to live with an awareness of no self. But the prospect of nano-age affluence, nano-neural technologies, and radical life extension will bring the problem of the illusory self to front and center for us all. Most immortalists and far future fiction writers imagine humans in a billion years that don't age, who are really smart, and who walk around in bodies. They may cast those bodies through cyberspace, or their bodies may be made of quantum computing devices, or they may be distributed across a cloud of nanodust, but they are still beings with the illusion of selfhood because they are embodied. That seems like a very unlikely outcome. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has just approved cyborg chipping of the completely paralyzed so that they can communicate with computers. This is the first step towards the breakdown of the illusion of discrete autonomous personhood. In a century, we will be able to copy, share, and sell our memories, beliefs, skills, and experiences. We will selectively adopt personalities for specific purposes. Machiavelli for politics, Cyrano for love. Some people will broadcast voyeur lives, just as some now put voyeur cams in their homes, and others will choose to spend a lot of time in someone else's life, like climbing into John Malkovich's head for weeks instead of 15 minutes at a time. Personalities will begin to bleed and blur. We will write copious reams about the decline of the old discrete continuous self and the rise of the new creative, collaborative self-process. Bioluddites have already started to gnash their teeth and wear hair shirts at the prospect, as in the U.S. President's Council on Bioethics report, Beyond Therapy, which bemoans the moral decadence that will follow when people can selectively erase painful memories. But no matter these desperate last-ditch jeremiads against cognitive self-determination, the technologies of nano-neural interfaces will usher in a post-individual age. The most dramatic challenges to our social and philosophic world will probably come from hive minds and distributed selves. Hive minds are familiar from Star Trek's Borg, people who merge their personalities, or more ominously, are merged, into a collective personality. We met distributed personalities in David Brin's most recent novel, Kiln People, in which each organic human begins the day by making a couple of temporary copies of herself to send out to work. Some wake up in a temporary body and know that they will be able to upload their memories back into the core personality at the end of the day. But others, the ones who work in unpleasant jobs, know that they will work for 48 hours and wink out. These disposable copies face the existential choice of serving their yesterday self or serving their today self and just going to the beach. Even if we never dive into a collective or spread ourselves across a small hive of clones and bush robots, we will be in constant high-bandwidth contact with millions of other people in varying degrees of intimacy. We will sync our relevant thought spaces to our party, church, and tribe, and share some core identity elements only with other group marriage spouses. Negotiating the degree of mental privacy required with life partners will undoubtedly be one of the most complicated hurdles in future civil union contracts. In that world, the nature of the current illusory, constantly changing self will have been fully revealed. Greg Egan imagines in the novel Diaspora that future machine minds will be so disturbed at the prospect of radical personality drift that they will consciously lock down parts of their personality, just as we now hide key program files on our computer, so that we don't accidentally erase them. But there really is no going back once you know that you could be a NASCAR fan instead of an opera fan with a flick of a switch. There is also something profoundly troubling about people deciding that they will never change their minds. Haven't we all vowed, when I grow up, I will never do X, only to discover that we've changed and those previous vows were silly? Would it be a better world if people who fell in love for the first time could lock down that feeling so that it never faded? Every time you looked at her, you would feel exactly the same thing, no matter who you met or how your life circumstances changed. Wouldn't a completely invariant core personality itself be a kind of death? Even if we try to persist with the comforting closure of a discrete, continuous self, our current binary options of death or continuing in embodied, isolated, illusory selfhood will have been replaced with myriad options more fantastic and varied than we can imagine. This whole line of thinking is part of the personal identity debate, and there is an enormous literature to reference, going back to Buddha, Locke, and Hume. But let's just note two of the most recent contributions. Extropian Max Moore wrote his dissertation on the transhumanist implications of the personal identity debate, and concluded that he thought you were still you, even if you go through a radical phase transition to become a Jupiter brain, so long as the Jupiter brain can remember how it changed from you into it. But Moore is still arguing that personal identity is a real thing instead of just an arbitrary and meaningless, if legally and psychologically necessary, fiction. Derek Parfit, on the other hand, argues in Reasons and Persons something similar to what I argue here, that the longer we live, the more tenuous the relationship our current selves will have to our future selves. One of the consequences of this view is that to the extent that you care about future people, it makes declining sense to be selfish. If you are as likely to be similar to and part of anybody in the future, then the farther into the future that you are thinking about, the more sense it makes to create a world that's good for everyone. You just don't know who you'll be. If Parfit is right, and I think he is, the BioLuddites are dead wrong that a world of radical life extension and nano-neural technology will be a more selfish world. It will be precisely a world where technology has revealed the absurdity of selfishness and the importance of acting in the greatest good for the greatest number. So bring on radical life extension. It will make us all happier, better people. And we will live long enough to honestly not fear death, partly because we will know that everything we are will continue on in some form. None of us will make it to that party at the heat death of the universe. But I think that the folks at that party will remember us fondly. That was an essay that I wrote for betterhumans.com in my regular Change Surfing column there last week called The Elusiveness of Immortality. You can access that at betterhumans.com. Stay tuned for a quick review of some of the transhumanist news of the week coming up next. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J. The most interesting news of the week, I thought, was out of Japan and Korea about the creation of a mouse out of two mouse eggs. And here's the news story from betterhumans.com. A genetic tweak has allowed scientists to overcome a barrier to so-called virgin births in mammals and produce a mouse from two embryos. The research by Tomohiro Kono and colleagues from Tokyo University of Agriculture in Japan suggests that a reason why mammals, unlike many other creatures, are unable to reproduce through parthenogenesis. Some researchers also think that the procedure could be used to produce stem cells for research, although it's not clear that the complicated technique is necessary to produce embryos capable of yielding stem cells. Parthenogenesis is the development of an organism from an unfertilized egg. Relatively common in plants as well as in some insects and lizards, parthenogenesis is essentially cloning, producing embryos containing only a female's genetic material. Commonly referred to as a virgin birth, the phenomenon doesn't occur naturally in mammals. Parthenogenesis can be induced in mammals through electric or chemical stimulus, and resulting embryos usually die within a few days. Scientists think that this is because the mammalian embryos need genetic material from both a female and a male. Eggs and sperm carry similar genes, but these genes have different patterns of activity, meaning that some genes are silent in eggs and others in sperm, a phenomenon called imprinting. Researchers are interested in developing mammalian parthenogenesis techniques for a number of reasons. Besides providing information about mammalian embryo development, parthenogenesis could provide new ways of generating cloned animals with valuable genetic traits. It could also provide embryos from which to derive stem cells, but existing parthenogenesis techniques that create non-viable embryos may be adequate for this task. For their research, Kono and colleagues used a genetic approach. They combined the nucleus from one mouse egg with the nucleus from another. The trick was that one egg came from a mouse genetically engineered to lack a gene called H19 and a region responsible for deactivating a gene called IGF2. These genes are thought to be involved in regulating the growth of a developing fetus. From 460 attempts, 10 live mice were born, which is one of the reasons why this wouldn't be ethical to do on humans yet. Just one, Kaguya, named after a girl in a Japanese fairy tale, survived to adulthood. Kaguya is now 14 months old, has her own pups, and is considered healthy. Kono aims to next apply the technique to pigs. The research is reported in the journal Nature. One of the very first reporters that I heard talking about this story quoted a scientist saying, "I think there's no practical application for this technology." Well, hello! We are talking about gay marriage all over the United States, all over Europe, and now all over the world. And one of the principal reasons why two women or two men might want to get married is so that they could have children. And there aren't very many options currently for two folks of the same gender to have children. And now we have an option for two women to have children together with this technique. And pretty soon we'll have options for two men to have children together as well. And this whole idea about the naturalness of the male-female bond may be just turned on its head by technology. So this particular technology raises all kinds of interesting questions about the future of sex, gender relations, and the rights and how intimately bound up the rights of sexual minorities and all kinds of minorities are with biotechnology. Some of you probably already know about the Methuselah Mouse Prize, which you can find at methuselahmouse.org. This is a prize that was started by Aubrey de Grey. He's a researcher, biogerontology researcher in England, who has an ambitious research program that he is promoting around the world, trying to get governments to take it seriously, where he wants to target six specific reasons why we age and see how we could extend healthy longevity by targeting these particular causes. And one step towards that is that he has started this prize, the Methuselah Mouse Prize, in order to promote the idea to encourage scientists to compete to make the longest lived mice. So each year, the mouse that has lived the longest, that can document, its researchers can document that it's lived the longest, will win the Methuselah Mouse Prize. And hopefully year by year, the age of those mice will increase, and eventually those therapies that are used on the mice will be able to be used on human beings. And the Methuselah Mouse Prize is encouraging people to donate to increase the pot so that researchers are more and more motivated to address themselves to these biogerontology goals. Well, this week, the news, again, from Better Humans, the engineered mouse keeps on ticking. Yoda turns 136 in human years. So this is the story. The world's oldest mouse has turned 136 in human years as it continues to teach researchers about aging and longevity. Yoda, a dwarf mouse, celebrated his fourth birthday on April 10th in quiet seclusion in his own cage with his mate, Princess Leia. The pair live in a rest home for geriatric mice belonging to Richard Miller, a professor of pathology at the Geriatric Center of the University of Michigan Medical School in Ann Arbor. Quote, Yoda is only the second mouse I know to have made it to his fourth birthday without the rigors of severe calorie-restricted diet, which is the principal way that we know of extending life expectancy, says Miller. He's the oldest mouse we've seen in 14 years of research on aged mice at UM. The previous record holder in our colony died 9 days short of his fourth birthday. Average lab mice live slightly more than 10 years. The world record holder died in January 2003, just a week short of 5 years, says Aubrey de Grey, a biologist and computer scientist at the University of Cambridge Department of Genetics. Researchers are interested in studying long-lived mice such as Yoda because they provide information about the aging process and methods of increased human longevity. Yoda has had genetic modifications that affected his pituitary gland, affected his thyroid, and reduced his production of insulin. The modifications also left him a third smaller than average mice and a highly sensitive to cold. He lives with Princess Leia so that she can keep him warm. About 100 other mice live in Yoda's lab, where they're being used for a study on lifespan. I gather that Yoda is a dwarf mouse with a mutation in a gene that is involved in the creation of the pituitary gland, says de Grey, co-founder of the Methuselah Mouse Prize, which aims to spur research into life extension. The gland makes three important hormones, and researchers believe that one of them, growth hormone, is the one responsible for the effect on lifespan, he says. Growth hormone may have some beneficial effects in the elderly, but it definitely seems to be bad to have too much of it during youth, and maybe prenatally. These mice have no pituitary, so hardly any growth hormone. Anti-aging interventions such as caloric restriction, consuming a diet with fewer calories, but all the essential nutrients of a normal diet, have proven to extend the lifespan of mice and delay the onset or reduce the incidence of many age-related diseases. The genetic approaches used in Miller's lab, however, continue to produce long-lived mice without the need to restrict their food intake. The mice provide clues about how genes and hormones affect the rate of human aging and the risks of diseases late in life. Miller's current work, for example, focuses on identifying defects in T cells from aged mice that interfere with a normal immune response and finding ways to reverse those defects. DeGray notes, however, that the implications of Yoda's longevity may not be much for human longevity. Those of us who have the misfortune to already be alive can't take advantage of the genetic modifications that Yoda had, he says. We have the option to do it the hard way, of course, by restricting our calories, but even there it's not clear what we would gain. There's no reason why restricting calories should give the same proportional life extension in humans as in mice, and in fact, there are good evolutionary reasons to think it will give us only a few years more at most. DeGray says that most humans need something that reverses age-related decline rather than just slowing it down, which is the focus of his work. It's not as hard as it sounds, he says. Of course, this news comes on the heels of news this week that reducing soda intake on the part of kids actually reduces their obesity rate, and that 10 to 20% of all calories in the American diet come from corn syrup sugar, and that corn syrup sugar may be directly the cause of the rise of diabetes in the United States. So although the decline in exercise may be the principal cause of the rise of obesity in the United States, the increase in corn syrup and other kinds of sugars in our diet is probably a contributing factor. I also wanted to share this piece of news from Stanford. This is an article that is actually a press release put out by the Stanford University Medical Center. For decades, people have nipped a wrinkle here, reduced a nose size there, or paid for help boosting test scores. With this history of paying to improve our bodies and minds, why not extend that liberty to memory-improving drugs or brain-enhancing implants? These and other questions being raised by modern neuroscience were the topic of a meeting of neuroscientists, ethicists, and psychologists funded by the National Science Foundation and the New York Academy of Sciences. The group, led by Judy Eales, senior research scholar in biomedical ethics and in radiology at the Stanford University School of Medicine, will publish their thoughts in the April 20th online issue of Nature Reviews Neuroscience. The article will also appear in the May print issue of the journal. The group's goals were to outline both the ethical issues raised by modern neuroscience and the steps scientists should take, if any. Plastic surgery and neural enhancement both raise safety issues, Eales said. However, she and co-chair Martha Farah, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, feel the risks are more acceptable when treating an illness rather than taking normal healthy people and trying to make them better. Eales said that the key difference between physical enhancements such as plastic surgery and neural enhancement through drugs or brain implants comes down to personhood. A nose job doesn't change who you are. Drugs might, she said. Am I the same person on Ritalin as off? Farah asked. Farah said that there have been no studies that establish the long-term effects of brain function in children who take Ritalin to control hyperactivity, or in people who take medication for depression. It could be that drugs alter the way the brain works, fundamentally changing personality. The drugs may even have unanticipated consequences, such as speeding up the brain's decline with old age. The question becomes more complicated for drugs such as modafinil, which can improve memory or the ability to concentrate. These have obvious appeal for professionals wanting an edge, but at what cost? I think it's important for science to move forward, Eales said. I worry about how the science will be conveyed to the public. Will it play on fears of not having a competitive edge? If the answer is yes, Eales brings up a few hypothetical situations. What if some people in a given field take a drug to make themselves doubly productive? Will their productivity put pressure on colleagues to use the drugs, much like some professional athletes feel competitive pressure to take steroids? Would differences in productivity cause conflicts between colleagues or inequalities in pay? These scenarios raise issues about what scientists should do to prevent the abuse of brain enhancement research. In their review, Eales and her colleagues quote Francis Fukuyama, the Omer L. and Nancy Hurst Professor of Public Policy at the Institute of Public Policy at George Mason University, who has called for legislation to control the use of drugs or devices that alter the way the brain functions. Legislation isn't necessary, according to the group, but caution is. Eales and Farah argue that by being proactive and thinking about ethical issues, ethicists, neurologists, and physicians can develop guidelines to aid decisions about how research findings are used and communicated to the public. Robert Cook Deegan, MD, director of the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy, hopes that such guidelines will distinguish between potentially harmful brain alterations and the type of brain-altering activities that have taken place since the dawn of civilization. Every time a person smokes a cigarette, drinks a glass of wine, or wakes up with a cup of coffee, the workings of that person's brain are being changed, he said. So how is taking a drug any different? Caffeine, then modafinil. What's next? Said Cook Deegan, co-author of the paper. Cook Deegan said drug treatments follow a well-trammeled path from development for treating a disease such as depression, Alzheimer's, or narcolepsy, to use for less established medical conditions. The drug Ritalin, used to treat children with attention deficit disorder, is a classic example. Where it was once a welcome relief to those rare parents with hard-to-manage kids, the drug is now widely prescribed and is even taken by college students needing help focusing before exams. In addition to drugs, Eel said that modern brain imaging techniques may reveal aspects of personality, such as the tendency to lie or be aggressive. As the technology improves, doctors must decide who should have access to this information and whether they should treat a neural tendency rather than an actual behavior. Eel said that the panel's discussion was limited to examples of what neuroscientists may be able to detect or treat in the future. Through such meetings, she hopes the medical community will be poised to act responsibly when those future technologies become a reality. Well, this is kind of unfortunate. This is an example of what we call bio-Luddite bias in bioethics, where the entire discussion is, oh my God, people are going to have control over their brains, and they're going to want to stay awake, and they're going to want to concentrate more, and they're going to want to perform better, and they're going to want to do this and that. And, yeah, so what? So what? So what if people want to stay awake, you know? Right now, some people drink coffee and some people don't. Does that mean that the people who don't drink coffee are at a systematic disadvantage and feel a pressure to drink coffee compared to those who do drink coffee? Because if you don't drink coffee, you're not going to get ahead in the workplace. That's absurd. Now, you know, there are questions here, legitimate questions that need to be taken into consideration, but the starting point should be that people have a right to control their own bodies and brains. And this is not the starting point that most of these bioethicists use. Their starting point is, if we can figure out that there's some problem someplace down the line, some question that we can raise, then we get to take your rights away. And that's not a good place to start. Now, if the only question here is, should people think about these things, then absolutely they should think about these things. But that's not the only question here. What most of these bioethicists want is for there to be some kind of restrictive legislation to make sure that people don't have access to, in this case, neuropharmaceuticals in order to control, through their own voluntary behavior, their own brains. And exactly as Cook Deegan says, what is the difference between modafinil and caffeine? It's only the degree of efficacy. If you want to take away modafinil because it keeps people awake, then you have to take away caffeine as well. Which is exactly the reasoning behind the drug legalization movement, which, as you know, I'm a strong supporter of. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.